Friends, you're listening to Irish Radio Network, USA, and my guest is His Excellency, David Donoghue, who is the permanent representative of Ireland to the United Nations, and has been in that position for the last couple of years. But let me, first of all, welcome Your Excellency, David Donoghue. Very welcome to the program, David.
Thank you very much, Adrian, and I don't insist on the excellency at all.
I know, but I mean, let me tell you, if you have it, we're going to use it. We know you indeed very well, you know, in not only in the Irish community, but we know a lot about you, and indeed your father, a very noted figure in New York University, NYU, and one of the organizers with Loretta Brennan Glucksman and Lou Glucksman of Glucksman Ireland House. So your pedigree is very, very New York. But tell us about yourself and where actually you born and bred and buttered.
I was born in Dublin, Adrian, and grew up there, apart from 1 year in Philadelphia when I was about 11, and a year in England. I've had a varied career as a diplomat. I've been in many countries, but I worked for a long time on the Northern Ireland issue, and in particular the peace process, so that kept me at home for quite a while. But I've been here for the last couple of years, and I'm enjoying New York greatly, I must say.
Your term, first of all, you're 40 years, 40 years plus now in foreign affairs and the diplomatic corps. What got you into it in the first place?
I felt comfortable living abroad, and for example, I did a university degree in modern languages and spent some time studying and working in Germany. So maybe I was attracted to the idea of a profession abroad. But to be perfectly honest, I always had an interest in public service. Difficult to explain why, but I felt that we are a small country. We have a relatively small administration. I felt that there would be particular satisfaction in devoting my skills to helping the state. And I was fortunate to be given some opportunities in which I could do that. And in particular, the Northern Ireland issue, although it was very difficult and challenging, ultimately it did represent an achievement for all of us. And so in that sense, I don't regret the choice of profession, but really it was a combination of liking a life spent to some extent abroad and wanting to serve the state.
In addition to Northern Ireland, you served as ambassador to the Holy See, for instance.
I was just a junior diplomat there, Adrian, but in fact it was my first post, and it was a very interesting time. It was in fact during my period there that we had the summer of three popes, which meant that a usually rather quiet post suddenly became hectic. That was the summer of 1978, and it gave me an attachment to Rome, which Rome in the cultural sense, I've had all my life.
And then you served in Germany and Austria, Russian Federation. How did that come about?
Well, you end up being asked to become head of mission in various posts in the Irish diplomatic service. It happened that after I had spent a number of years in Belfast, a vacancy arose as ambassador to Russia, and off I went there. I found that particularly interesting because it coincided with the first 2 years of Putin being in office, and literally the day I arrived in Moscow was Putin's first day, and the first visitor whom Putin had as Prime Minister. He was initially Prime Minister. His first visitor was Bertie Ahern, the Taoiseach of the day, and I found myself on my second day in Moscow at lunch hosted by Putin. So it was a great introduction, mind you.
Yes.
Perhaps this isn't the occasion to offer my views on the same man, but it certainly made for an interesting time in a challenging post.
Your years in the bulk of two decades in the diplomatic relations with Northern Ireland, was that something that coincided? Where was Ireland at, and where was the relationship with Northern Ireland when you went there?
That was a very interesting question. I started in 1975 in the what was then a tiny Anglo-Irish division in the Department of Foreign Affairs, and I finished in the same division in 1999. And although I wasn't continuously working on Northern Ireland, I felt that at the time of the Good Friday Agreement, I had spent quite a significant part of my career working on Anglo-Irish issues. A key change was what happened in 1985, the Anglo-Irish Agreement, and I was a very junior member of the team which helped to negotiate the Anglo-Irish Agreement, but that put the Irish government into a pivotal position in terms of policy. You know that up to that point, the involvement of the Irish government had been strongly resisted by successive British governments, but this gave us a formal role, and really it set a platform for subsequent developments in the peace process. And I had further role in the events of the 1990s, mainly based in Dublin, but for a period I was the head of our representation in Belfast. And during that period I had a detailed involvement in the peace process culminating in the negotiation of the Good Friday Agreement. And I would certainly regard my involvement at that stage as one of the most powerful and lasting experiences that I had in the Irish Foreign Service. I will never forget the day of Good Friday 1998 and the catharsis which it created, the sense of a new beginning, and indeed it is still with us today.
Going back 15 years, you became Director General of the Irish Government's Development Cooperation Programme. That was Irish Aid. What was the significance of that particular time year?
At that time, Adrian, the Irish government was happily in a position to increase significantly the amount of money we were spending on development cooperation, and therefore it was an exciting time to be the official in charge of the programme. You're quite right, today it's called Irish Aid. At that time it had a slightly different name, but we were expanding, we were deepening our involvement in particular programme countries or priority countries, yes, mainly in Eastern Africa and Sub-Saharan Africa, and we were also going into one or two new countries. So I found that a very rewarding experience, as indeed I think does everyone who works on development cooperation issues.
Yeah, last year was the 60th anniversary of Ireland's entry into the United Nations. Again, what was the impetus? What actually brought Ireland into the United Nations? Were they asked to come in? Or they?
Well, the United Nations, of course, was formed after the Second World War, and we had an interest in joining as soon as possible, along with many other European countries, for reasons to do with the policies of the Soviet Union at the time, we were not able to join until 1955. But with a group of other countries, we joined then, and hence the 60th anniversary last year. It would be fair to say that from the beginning we played a role which involved punching above our weight. One thinks of Frank Aiken's involvement within a couple of years of entry in the negotiations which led to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. And Ireland really acquired quite a distinctive profile in areas like peacekeeping, human rights, and in development policy. So I'd like to I see the 60 years as a formative period in terms of Ireland's own foreign policy. We created a role and a profile for ourselves at the UN, which was linked closely to our own values as a people.
Right. In peacekeeping, and indeed with respect to human rights, we some of us find it rather difficult to assume that the military aspect of that, our contribution to the military for a small country, again, like Ireland, that might raise some eyebrows and say, excuse me?
Well, I think it's important to recognize that it's peacekeeping. So this is, if you like, the UN trying to preserve peace which has been established. So the Irish troops or any other peacekeeping troops were not there to take offensive military action, but were there to maintain
the peace
and consolidate peace. But, of course, we have always seen value in serving the United Nations, and this was a role which we were asked to undertake from the very beginning in the Congo in 1960. And since then, Ireland has acquired actually a very strong reputation as one of the most impartial and reliable of peacekeeping countries. Indeed, we have built up particular skills. We've been in South Lebanon, for example, I think three times now, and we are one of the go-to countries when the UN needs a particularly experienced and professional set of peacekeepers for a volatile situation.
What are the divisions or the prominent divisions within the Irish Embassy here to the UN?
The priorities which we set are really those of the government and of policy documents which the government has issued in relation to foreign affairs. But it would be fair to say that at present, development cooperation is the top priority for reasons I can explain in a moment. We also will have a we are a candidate for the Security Council at an election which will be held in June 2020 with reference to a two-year term from 2021 to 2022. So over the next few years we will be intensifying our efforts to be elected to the Security Council. Other priorities are in the area of human rights. We were, for example, a member of the Human Rights Council, a body of the UN, in Geneva over the 3 years which finished in December. And we also have an involvement in the whole set of issues around peace building, conflict resolution, mediation, the quite valuable work that the UN can do in conflict situations and where we rely on our own experience of the Northern Ireland peace process.
Last year, indeed, Ireland was honoured and you had a very significant role as permanent representative to the United Nations, appointed to co-facilitate the final phase of negotiations on this new global development agenda. Can you give us a synopsis of what that is and Was that revised? Was
certainly it? Well, it was a great privilege and an honor to be asked to take on that particular role. I was invited by the President of the General Assembly, along with the Ambassador of Kenya, to co-chair, as it were, negotiations which eventually produced new global development goals for the period 2015 to 2030. You may have heard of the Millennium Development Goals, which yeah. were announced in the year 2000 and which were valid until 2015. It was recognized that we would need a successor set of goals for the next 15 years, but this time round they were to be extremely wide-ranging, so they cover poverty eradication in all its forms, but also climate change, saving the planet, and creating conditions for balanced economic growth. All of this comes under the heading Sustainable Development, and the name of the new goals is the Sustainable Development Goals, the SDGs for short, sometimes called the 2030 Agenda. Last September, the Taoiseach and President Higgins came to New York to take part in a summit of world leaders which formally adopted those goals. I happen to be the co-facilitator or co-chairman of the process of the negotiations among the 193 member states leading up to that adoption.
You obviously did a good job, because you have this year a new goal and a new honor, we should say, for Ireland with respect to refugees. And sometimes we have to remind ourselves that we are actually talking about global initiatives rather than just Ireland and the United
exactly.
States.
Well, again, I was fortunate to be asked to take on that role. It came rather quickly. I didn't have much time to rest from the last one, but it is a great global challenge this year, there is no doubt about it. The UN has the potential to reach a new global agreement to help to address the issues relating to both refugees and migrants in a broader sense. So right. there will be a summit this coming September on the global migrant and refugee crisis, and Ireland has been asked with Jordan to co-chair the negotiations in relation to that summit. It is linked to the outcome of the Sustainable Development Goals negotiations. Right. I think there is a link, and we have a lot of work ahead of us. I suspect in many ways it will be more challenging than the work on the new global goals, because you can see the deep divisions which exist all around the world, and not just in Europe, on how to deal with the huge humanitarian crisis represented by the flows of refugees. We see them coming from Syria, but also Afghanistan, Iraq. There are many, many parts of the world which are experiencing refugee movements. And then you have the wider issue of economic migrants who haven't really been given sufficient attention by the UN up to now, and the aim will be to find new policy principles which will cover both. So it's an honour for Ireland to have been asked to help to find a global solution to this crisis.
Yeah, on the migrant issues again, which has it smacks of those who want to improve their lot in life, and you know, again, economically and in many other ways. Is there a distinction, are the issues of migrants versus refugees, are those two different?
Up to now, those issues have been handled separately, and indeed there are separate UN organizations which deal with each. But strictly speaking, refugees are a subset of a wider category of vulnerable people who are migrating. The refugees have legal protection from the Refugee Convention, and that legal protection is sacrosanct, and we will be looking for ways of reinforcing it. But economic migrants are people who, for many, many different reasons, leave their countries of origin and choose to move elsewhere. Now, the Refugee Convention, strictly speaking, relates to people who, for reasons of political persecution,
right,
leave their countries. We're obviously seeing a range of other factors, war and deprivation of various kinds, which are forcing thousands of Syrians to leave their homes. So we need really a single overriding framework which will address the problems of both refugees in the narrower sense and migrants.
We do know that a lot of the educational entities in the United States, and my daughter Linda, who is an assistant principal in a school here in Long Island, is part of an initiative to get through to the UN and to use the UN to create awareness of education, basic education, to the entire world. And it seems like sometimes, well, you know, depending on how you look at it, well, that's not going to happen, and it hasn't happened, but there is something happening on a broader scale, and that is that the international this international approach and awareness that, wait a minute, you know, whereas we address hunger, we address famine, many of the same issues that Ireland went through themselves, the right of a human being to be able to read, write, to comprehend.
Absolutely. In fact, you put your finger on something there, Jean. One of the new global goals I referred to, and there were 17 of them, one of them relates to education. So that makes clear that that every country in the world now recognizes the importance of education in terms of human development. So education is up there squarely as one of the goals that we will all be tackling. And indeed, it's to the credit of the UN that it's only really at the UN that we can focus global attention on these big issues. So there are many subsidiary aspects of the education goal,
right,
maternal education, primary education. There are many aspects which we will be addressing through the new 2030 agenda, but your daughter is absolutely right and is to be applauded for what she's doing.
Yeah. Let me just ask you about the UN and the funding of the UN and how countries are actually valued by way of contribution, starting off, say, the monetary contribution.
Well, there is a key system for deciding what each member state contributes. And that basically depends on the country's own resources and
economic
circumstances. One of the issues is the punctuality with which countries will pay their contributions, and Ireland is among those which always pay on time. There are some other countries, including one not very far from us, which has sometimes been a bit slow, not under this administration, I should say. But on the whole, all member states try to ensure that they pay fully and on time. The UN, nevertheless, is always under financial pressure. There are escalating demands, new issues coming on stream the whole time, and peacekeeping, for example, is issue of fundamental importance for the UN. And there, for example, the US pays an enormous bill. The US pays a huge bill, and one can see the demands escalating almost on a daily basis, new crisis situations in Africa. So it is hard to keep up with all of the demands, and therefore it is important that member states honour their commitments as punctually as they can.
There are a couple of areas of that are very much associated with, and rightly so, with Ireland and the Irish people. One is that we are, by our very nature, a very charitable contributor. It is said that Ireland per capita is among the most generous in the world, and that somehow there is some kind of an historical tie going back to our own famine, and that we really have an innate feeling, and that we were able to respond to destitution, and therefore maybe that has
exactly that certainly explains the huge commitment by Irish governments and the Irish people over the years to development cooperation. It's on the one hand a question of the funding which the Irish state provides for development cooperation, but also then the generosity of ordinary Irish people going back over decades. It is true that we have this reputation, and there is strong public support in Ireland for a generous development cooperation program, even in times of difficulty. We've seen it in the last few years during our recession, when the government managed to keep a very sizable level of spending with public support, even though there were clearly many issues at home which needed attention. So it's something we can be proud of, and we compare well by international standards.
Are the fact, and it is a fact, that when you take the NGOs like Concern and Goal and many of the others that are predominantly Irish, they're being to the forefront of some amazingly difficult, dangerous situations, that has to garner some degree of recognition in the United Nations. So,
well, first of all, the NGOs you mentioned, Adrian, they have a very good reputation at the UN already, there is a recognition of the great role which they play in developing countries. The role which Ireland plays as a development partner involves partly state expenditure on development cooperation programs which we have in individual countries in Africa. It also includes funding which we provide to NGOs such as those you mentioned. Of course, they raise their own funds in addition. And it also includes the generosity of ordinary citizens who contribute on a day-to-day basis. So the collective Irish image is the way you describe it, and it does, in my view, go back to our own historical experiences. And may I say that one priority area for Irish aid in the last 10 years or so has been the question of food security and nutrition. Yes. There we have done important work with the US and others in highlighting the vital importance of addressing nutrition issues, and that undoubtedly goes back to our famine experience.
Yes. Well, before the establishment of the United Nations, indeed, Ireland had indeed gained its own reputation through our missionaries worldwide. I've mentioned many times that we were of the opinion that missionaries went into the darkest corners of the world, with a big stick trying to introduce Christianity, preferably Catholicism, into these people here who we felt, that our duty was to bring them closer to the one true Catholic faith as such. Truth of the matter is that as we look back, missionaries were actually doing the work, even though it wasn't perhaps widely known at the time, of catering to the poor, taking people who had practically nothing, and improving their lot in life.
Indeed, there's no question about it. The missionaries performed amazing work, providing education and health facilities in some of the poorest countries in the world. Now, they are, at this stage, dying out, perhaps as a community,
right,
and as a tradition. But I've travelled in many developing countries in Africa, and I had the privilege to accompany our president once on a trip which she made to Uganda and Kenya, specifically to visit the missionaries. And you wouldn't believe the examples of self-sacrifice which these men and women had provided over the years. Astonishing. I should also say that in some African countries still, you have half the cabinet who will have been educated by Irish missionaries, and that, of course, has also strengthened the image of the country in those parts of the world.
The United Nations, in many countries and in many areas, takes a rap in the sense that when we hear of scandals in particular, for instance, huge commitment to food and to aid and to to countries that are war torn or are at the butt of the world's worst form of humanity, that the United Nations, we look at the United Nations and say, what are they doing? Aren't they supposed to be monitoring this? Aren't they supposed to be the peacekeeper? Aren't they supposed to know what their job is? An easy one to...
Well, no organization is perfect, and of course the United Nations is only as good as its members, it's only as good as its financial resources, but there have been undoubtedly the episodes you're talking about, and each time, though, the UN has made a genuine effort to reform its own structures to ensure that such things don't happen again. It is fair, I take as an example at present revelations about child abuse on the part of individual peacekeepers in particular countries. That is an appalling outrage. It is something which every government at the UN would denounce, but we are seeing action being taken by the UN now to ensure that can never happen again.
I do want to ask you about the membership of the United Nations. Are there categories like Chinese menu A, B, and C in terms of those who are in a position to contribute? Those who are there like cubby holes where you say, okay, Ireland, that's where Ireland is going to be, but you'll also find them in other categories.
No.
How is that even determined?
The great virtue of the United Nations, Adrian, is its universality. So there are 193 member states. Each one is absolutely equal. The largest country in the world has no more of a vote than the smallest country in the world. In the Security Council, there is a different arrangement where five countries, as you know, have permanent membership and veto rights that go with that.
Yes.
But apart from that, in the General Assembly, there is a fundamental principle of each country being equal. That means that there are no categories of more important countries vis-a-vis less important countries. Each country, in effect, contributes according to its means. There is a key, as I say. And
I just want to ask, do they have an equal opportunity then to be... You know, to be a part of the overall decision-making, whatever.
very good issue, very good point. Let me come back to the question of membership of the Security Council. That would be seen as, in effect, joining the executive board of the organization.
Right.
A country like Ireland would expect or would hope to be a member of the Security Council perhaps once every 20 years on average.
Right.
And we therefore launch campaigns to secure that. Every country in the world can, in theory, become a member of the Security Council. Of course, it will be more difficult for some of the tiniest developing states with tiny administrations. It will be more difficult for them to sustain membership, to actually be able to operate over the 2 years concerned. But it is in principle open to even the smallest country of the world to seek membership of the Security Council. And that is, if you like, that is a major opportunity at the UN. In practice, it tends to be countries who are sufficiently equipped with resources to be able to manage over the 2 years. But I emphasize it is a universal organization, and if we are looking for votes, we will have to get, you know, support from the smallest countries as well as from the largest countries.
Absolutely, yeah.
I don't want to name countries, but the largest is no more important than the smallest.
We do know that you and indeed your colleagues at the mission, you do get out and reach out to places. You speak at universities, so you're not actually operating with the post office box. Is this something relatively new in terms of saying?
Well, I suppose public diplomacy is part of the duties of any Irish diplomat and ambassador. And I try to take whatever opportunities come my way, and I know that my predecessors did as well.
Yeah.
But it is true that we don't have a role in terms of interacting with the Irish community, for example. That is clearly the responsibility of the embassy in Washington and of all the consuls, including the one here. So our role is to represent Irish interests at the United Nations. But outside the UN, there are opportunities to demonstrate the work that we're doing, to speak to individual think tanks and universities and academic groups, and we do take that on more and more. I mean, it is simply part of our duty to explain what this work is. I wouldn't quite use the word secretive in relation to I know what you mean, and I certainly am committed to openness, and I'm delighted to have this opportunity of an important audience to be able to explain what we do at the mission to the UN. We have visitors in every half hour of all kinds. They
sure,
are NGOs, other diplomats, interest groups. Many of them want to express views to us about the work which we were doing on the Sustainable Development Goals, or indeed on migration and refugee issues. So we have a constant interaction with sort of an international public who want to make points to Ireland.
When there is a shortage, for instance, of blood for hospitals, and there is this outcry for a crisis situation, we're all asked to come on board and respond to this. What is the equivalent MO, say, of the United Nations? Is there a way that you can say, okay, we're under ferocious pressure now? Is there a period where you have absolutely outrageous, immediate demands? Is there some kind do you have any money in the bank?
I'm not sure there. I mean, in relation to workload, if you mean times of the year when we are under great stress,
yeah,
that would be in the month of September each year, when we have the opening of the General Assembly and the Minister of Foreign Affairs of the day comes for a week here and fulfills various duties.
Yeah.
But in terms of workload, that is certainly a major period of pressure. And it's the same for every
yes.
mission to the UN. But you may possibly have meant something else.
Yes. What I'm saying is there a time when the needs worldwide are so in such demands, not necessarily in money, but that there are despite all of the great work of the United Nations, there aren't enough NGOs. There isn't enough money. How is that monitored?
That's a very important issue. There are times when, frankly, one despairs about the right action being taken by the UN on particular issues. Let me take an example: Syria. For a number of reasons, it has not been possible for the Security Council to be as decisive in relation to Syria as many of us would like. Of course, the Security Council has been able to take specific action, for example, on humanitarian aspects of the,
right.
of the problem there. But the political composition on the Security Council is such that they haven't been able to agree particular decisions that some of us would feel were necessary. That can lead to a disillusionment with the UN. I wouldn't represent it in terms of a crisis or a feeling that the whole thing is worthless, but there are times when optimism is in short supply. On the other hand, there are times when, against the odds, a decision can come through which was not expected. I think, for example, of a resolution on the disposal of chemical weapons in Syria a couple of years ago, which suddenly proved possible because the US and Russia at the time were able to reach agreement. There are other, I mean, dare I say it, the Sustainable Development Goals last year were regarded as the most important achievement of the United Nations in decades. And
since its formation, it would be indeed acceptable.
Many people said that it was an unprecedented breakthrough for the UN, and the UN itself was hugely relieved and delighted that it was possible to get this agreement over the line. I feel somewhat bashful saying all that, but it's objectively the case that it was seen as the greatest thing the UN has done in a long time, and therefore there is confidence about the UN being able to take on new global challenges, for example, relating to migration and refugees. We had a climate change agreement in Paris, a UN brokered climate change agreement, which was remarkable. Those are among the achievements of last year. 2015 was seen as a momentous year, and coincidentally it was 70 years since the UN had been founded. So there was a great sense of euphoria at the end of 2015, and it's still with us right now.
I want to thank you for your time. I do want to come back to just, as we started, a bit about the Donoghues. Your father, how did he happen to be in New York and at NYU, the establishment of Glaxman Ireland House?
Well, he came here in 1978 as a professor to New York University. He had previously been the head of the Department of Modern English and American Literature in UCD. He was always particularly expert on American literature, going back to the late 40s, early 50s, and he was quite productive. So I think that it wasn't a major surprise that he got the appointment in NYU. And there he was a reasonably prominent Irish member of the staff who was thrilled when the opportunity came along to open this center or to have a resource like this in NYU. So he made his own contribution. Of course, the key movers and shakers there were Lou and Loretta.
Finally, I just want to ask you about the weekend that's in it, and the Donahue family. I know that many of us are looking forward, of course, to tomorrow night. But you have a particular connection.
Well,
I want you to tell us about it. Your sister.
Well, I have a sister. I have five sisters, but my youngest sister is one in whom we're all taking particular pride at present, because Emma wrote the novel Room, which was converted into a wonderful film directed by Lenny Abramson. She also wrote the screenplay for that film, and Room has been nominated for in four categories for the Oscars. Naturally, I have a particular hope that she might succeed in the screenplay category. But we're all looking forward to the ceremony. It's great for Emma. It's great for the film. It's great for the Irish film industry, and it's hard to suppress a feeling of excitement about it. I'm a lifelong cinema fan, and I would have liked ideally to be in Los Angeles, but they allow one family member, and rightly brought her partner with her, so I wish her all the best, and
we all do, because it's going to be great anyway, and Ireland is now having such amazing success in film, and my guest, His Excellency David Donahue, friends, permanent representative of Ireland to the United Nations, and somebody we're all very proud of.
Thank you.
You're listening to Irish Radio Network, USA.